It is my pleasure to introduce Professor Rabbi Michael Abroyd, who I must say is one of the rare people who manages to have accomplishments that are really impressive, both in the academic world and in the rabbinic world. There are many of us who have a little bit of a connection to both worlds, but most of us who are in both of these worlds have most of our accomplishments only in one of those worlds, and he has accomplishments in both of them. He is an associate professor of law at Emory University in the School of Law and the academic director of the Law and Religion program at his university, and he is also a dayan, a member of the Beit Din of America, the largest Jewish law court in America. He writes articles, and he works lema'aseh, practically, in areas of Jewish law that are on the cutting edge and are of the greatest importance to the Jewish community today, the questions of prenuptial agreements, questions of agunot, and many other issues that we are dependent on having people of his stature with great rabbinical knowledge and great academic knowledge who can work in these areas. And I don't think it says this here, but he's also a congregational rabbi with a congregation in Atlanta. It's a pleasure to introduce Rabbi Professor Michael Abroyd.
My wife says I do many things poorly, so it's always nice to go someplace else and hear an alternative point of view. She's probably right, though. That's the scary thing. The topic that I wanted to talk about today is the relationship between halacha, Jewish law, and scientific facts. And it's another way of thinking about rabbinic authority, but most centrally, I wish to talk about process in Jewish law, to think on some very important levels what halacha does as the reality around us changes. Or the reality remains the same, but we discover new realities, and these new realities cause us to perhaps reevaluate certain halachic principles. The theme of this lecture is that as our knowledge of the facts grows and grows, we frequently encounter tensions between those facts that are well established and various halachot, technical, precise halachot, and different poskim, different halachic authorities have developed different ways of analyzing these various problems. We're going to survey four or five of them, and then I'm going to conclude by voicing my own opinion on the success or lack of success of certain techniques. The first source, I guess, and perhaps the most important, is the Gemara in Pesachim, on Daf 94, which discusses the various questions of astronomy. And the crucial manifestation of this discussion is the fact that the Gemara concludes in the name of Rebbe, in the name of Rebbe Yehuda Nasi, Nirin Divrehem Midivreinu. The knowledge of astronomy found in the secular world around the rabbis, he says, is greater than the knowledge of astronomy found in the Jewish community, and we should accept their knowledge of the facts that are out there as greater than or more technically correct than the view taken internal to the rabbinic tradition. And thus, Rebbe is of the view that when it comes to factual questions of astronomy, there's nothing wrong with turning to astronomers and asking them what the facts might be. And the astronomers will tell us what the facts might be, and we will take those facts and apply them to the halacha, and from those facts we will develop normative halacha to the extent, Rebbe would say, that we get the facts wrong. The halacha will inevitably come out incorrect, but you know what? It won't be our problem, because we need not have an autonomous basis for the facts ourselves in the rabbinic community. We will take the facts from the secular community in matters of astronomy, and we will apply them Now, as the computer scientists will tell you, the saying is garbage in, garbage out. And what do we mean by that? It means Rebbe's prepared to acknowledge the possibility that as the secular world produces incorrect data in matters of astronomy, we will nonetheless take it as the best knowledge available out there. And because it's the best knowledge available out there, we will use it to the best of our ability to discuss whatever we can discuss in any given halachic matter. Sometimes you will find medieval halachic authorities who, when discussing how various factual scenarios in the Gemara differ from their own assertion of reality, they will invoke a phrase that we will come back to. They will invoke the phrase called Nishtana Hatzavayim. The reality has changed around us, and they will use this principle to note that we should change the halacha because the facts that were present in the time of the Gemara are different than the facts that are present nowadays. And as these facts change, the halacha that generates them from also will change. Thus, the Magen Avraham tells us, speculates to the possibility that it might no longer be prohibited to eat fish and meat together. The Gemara tells us that the eating of fish and meat together was dangerous. And the Magen Avraham says, he looks around and he's consulted with various people and there no longer is a danger. He can't explain why there no longer is a danger, but he invokes the phrase of Nishtana Hatzavayim. The reality has changed. And thus he's prepared to contemplate the possibility that the custom of not eating fish and meat together should no longer be observed because the facts have changed. Now, the most famous application of this comes from the Encyclopedia Pachad Yitzchak by Lampronati. Rabbi Lampronati was a 1700s halachic authority. He's discussing whether or not it's permissible to kill kinim. Kinim were, we would colloquially translate them as lice. The Gemara remarks that it's permissible to kill lice on Shabbos because lice are spontaneously generated. And since they are spontaneously generated, they don't have the status of a creature because they're not born from one creature to another. And thus, they're permissible to be killed on Shabbos. The Pachad Yitzchak says, this is not true. This isn't true anymore. This is no longer true. This never was true. They were not spontaneously generated in the time of the Talmud. They weren't spontaneously generated at the time that the Rambam codified this halacha. They weren't spontaneously generated at the time the Tur codified this halacha. They were never spontaneously generated. This assertion in the Talmud is, he says, a factual mistake. And since it is a factual mistake, he says we should ignore it. We should acknowledge that the Gemara got the facts wrong. We should take the fundamental principle of the Gemara and apply it in all cases. The fundamental principle of the Gemara is that things that were born can't be killed on Shabbos. Things that are spontaneously generated, of which the Pachad Yitzchak says there are none, they can be killed on Shabbos. If you bring me kinim, lice, and you want to know if they can be killed on Shabbos, even though there's an explicit Talmudic statement codified in the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch permitting them to be killed, the Pachad Yitzchak says the killing of lice on Shabbos is a Torah prohibition, and one who does so sins, because the Talmudic assertion, the factual assertion found in the Gemara about the status of kinim, is wrong. And because it's wrong, we should change the basic, we should change the application of halacha so as to generate the right result. The right result being the one that the scientists in our generation tell us is factually correct. Now, the Pachad Yitzchak's view is the starting point for almost all contemporary discussion about science, because in one way or another, almost everybody responds to the observation of the Pachad Yitzchak. Either they respond by acceptance or denial or some other tool. But the Pachad Yitzchak is telling for us the most important basic possible response, which is the response that we would call full acceptance of scientific data. This full acceptance of scientific data causes the recasting of halacha, so that things that were heretofore found in the Svarim, in the Poskim, in the Shulchan Aruch, they should be crossed out. Beneath the cross out, we should write in the margins, this is no longer scientifically correct, and we should instead go back to the Gemara to examine them for the basic underlining principle and write the halacha correctly in light of the basic underlining principle. The contrary view, interestingly enough, is Rabbi Dessler. Rabbi Dessler, who Dr. Berger made reference to, he is the primary advocate deeply on the other side. And he says something that I find very difficult to accept. Rabbi Dessler says the exact opposite answer. Rabbi Dessler says, Rabbi Dessler, by the way, was a modern person. Rabbi Dessler, I think, died in 1960, spent time in the modern Western world in various degrees, and was moderately familiar with science. Rabbi Dessler, to solve the problem of scientific inaccuracy in the Gemara, adopts a view of science that's perfectly reasonable. Rabbi Dessler says, all scientific facts, as the scientists tell us nowadays, are true. So he's not in what we would call the full deniers of science, who we'll come to later on. So too, he says, all of the halachot in the Gemara are also true. So the questioner says, well, they both can't be true because they point in different directions. Rabbi Dessler recasts for us then our basic understanding of the purpose of Gemara. Rabbi Dessler says, you should not take too seriously the reasons given for any given halacha in the Gemara. Sometimes, he says, always, the Gemara, the Tanayim and the Amoraim have a well-established Mesorah tradition as to what the halacha ought to be. And this well-established tradition, he says, predates any scientific explanation the rabbis might give to it. Sometimes, in order to make the halacha more palpable to the masses, the rabbis used to give scientific explanations for the halachot. But of course, he says, these scientific explanations are merely nonsensical reasons that we tell people to do something. They're not the intellectual foundation for halacha at all. And when science disproves any particular reason, we should abandon this reason, but we should never abandon the halacha, because the halacha comes from God straight down. And even if the rabbis gave us a reason and the reason turns out to be wrong, that's because the rabbis felt a need to explain things that they themselves didn't fully understand. So he says the rabbis had a halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai, so to speak, an ancient tradition that kinim could be killed. They couldn't explain this tradition even as they knew it well. And when all of a sudden the scientists of their era said, kinim are spontaneously generated, the rabbis grabbed that and said, that must be the reason. But in fact, Rabbi Dessler says, now that we know that's not the reason, that doesn't change the halacha one whit. The halacha remains, kinim can be killed. We don't know why. And other insects cannot be killed on Shabbos. And we don't know why for that either. He says, don't take Gemara learning too seriously. Interestingly enough, this is a very profound affirmation of rabbinic authority, which returns me to a topic about which I know nothing about, other than in a very practical sense. Rabbi Dessler tells us a very important concept which I don't believe, which is that you have to be exceedingly, exceedingly careful not to listen to the reasons given to us by even the Talmudic rabbis, because every single aspect of Talmud learning has a basic element of halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai, or mesorah, to it. And because of that fact, even when a reason is given, the reason sometimes is bogus. And the rationale doesn't necessarily support the decision. The decision stands on its own because that was the ancient venerated tradition found among the rabbis. Rabbi Dessler's answer also, just like the Pachad Yitzchak's answer, was startling and generated a literature, because it almost argues for the irrelevance of analytic learning in halacha psuka. If you take Rabbi Dessler at his face value, when you learn a sugya and you understand the analysis of the sugya and you think you've logically got it under control, you still have no tool of any value in thinking about normative halacha. And indeed, there were many halachic authorities who critiqued the approach of Rabbi Dessler, the most significant of which being the Chazon Ish, who argued that Rabbi Dessler, in order to save two truths, which is save the truth of science, he was not prepared to deny the truthfulness of science because he knew it to be true as a matter of the physical world, and he wasn't prepared to abandon halachot the way the Pachad Yitzchak was, in essence sacrificed learning as a form of Torah study that generates halacha, because Rabbi Dessler, in essence, says the reasons given in venerated sources to determine what the halacha ought to be is not relevant. Instead, all that you do is you follow rabbinic authority wherever it might take you, independent of the reasons that are presented. The Chazon Ish comes perilously close, without mentioning Rabbi Dessler by name, to call this the ultimate heresy. Because the ultimate heresy, the Chazon Ish maintains, is the denial of the fact that the rabbis engaged in analytic thinking, Talmudic-based learning, gave reasons and thought the reasons were analytically persuasive. According to Rabbi Dessler, when the rabbi said you can kill kinim on Shabbos because the kinim, the lice, were spontaneously generated, Rabbi Dessler said, they're kidding. If I had said this to my Rebbe in ninth grade, he would have hit me. And I came from a school where you weren't allowed to hit the Talmidim, and he still would have hit me. Because what's the point of engaging in learning, the Chazon Ish says, if in fact you can cross off a line in the Gemara and say, this line is just kidding. It's not just that you don't have to take the Agadotah so seriously. Rabbi Dessler says, you know what? You don't even have to take the analysis itself so seriously. Just circle the bottom line halachot, as are found in the Gemara, and that's what you should follow. Pay no attention to the reasons given in any way, shape, or form. The Chazon Ish finds this position very difficult, unbelievable. And he finds the position of the Pachad Yitzchak, that the rabbis just got it wrong, to be two steps too modern for him. Just a little bit over the curve of where the Chazon Ish can imagine himself being. So instead, the Chazon Ish adopts the tool and the technique found in the Magen Avraham that I had mentioned before. The Chazon Ish says, look, we have no doubt that the reality of science is correct. We have no doubt at all that the rabbis in Talmudic times must have gotten the reality correct in their time, because after all, they were smart guys, and how do smart guys get the reality wrong? So it must be, he says, that nishtana hatavayim, the reality has changed in the 1500 years or 1800 years since the Gemara was written, and our reality is a correct assertion of our reality, and their assertion of what the reality looks like is a correct assertion of their reality, and the rules of nature or physics must have changed. And the Chazon Ish says this about a whole variety of topics, from the survivability of seven-month fetuses to how the Vans deferens work in a man, to a variety of other issues of practical normative halacha. The Chazon Ish says that the physics of our time are correct for our time, but the physics of their time work differently. Now, this position, while at first level seems deeply satisfying because the Chazon Ish has crafted a position that allows you to say you can have your cake and eat it too, the Chazon Ish ends, however, with a profound assertion. The Chazon Ish says, when the rabbis made a rabbinic decree grounded in their version of reality, their version of reality binds us, even if it's now wrong, because we don't have the halachic authority to undo a rabbinic decree, even as the reality changes. So the Chazon Ish accepts that fish and meat are no longer dangerous, meaning fish and meat can be eaten together without generating any physiological danger. He accepts that if the rabbis were alive nowadays, they would not have made this decree in light of the reality of our times. But since they made this decree, we're bound by it because we are, after all, rabbinic Judaism. And as rabbinic Judaism, we are bound by explicit decrees of Talmudic rabbis. Now, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein deals with the exact same case, accepts every single logical point the Chazon Ish makes, except for the final conclusion. The Talmud states that a man with only one testicle is incapable of having a child. When he marries a woman, the assumption is, and the woman gives birth to a child, the child is what? A mamzer. Because the woman must have had the child from somebody else, because this man can't have children. And Rav Moshe writes that nowadays, you know what we know? This is not true. He says, we know medically that men with only one testicle can marry and have children. And Rabbi Feinstein says, we must say nishtana hatzavayim, the reality has changed. And since the reality has changed, Rabbi Feinstein says, in a very, very, very famous tshuva, the third tshuva in the second chayuk of Evin Ezer, nowadays, a man with only one testicle is allowed to remarry, is allowed to marry. He does not have the status of a pitsua daka, of a man who's been castrated. When his wife gives birth to children, those children are fully legitimate and his. And the reason why this is so is he says, nishtana hatzavayim, the reality has changed. And in Talmudic times, men with but one testicle could not give birth. In modern times, men with one testicle can, for whatever reason, give birth. And the halacha has to change to keep up with changes in the reality as we perceive it. So Rabbi Feinstein and the Chazon Ish disagree profoundly on nothing other than a conclusion. Meaning they agree on every logical step until the very last one. The Chazon Ish says we're stuck with rabbinic decrees made by Talmudic sages even when the facts are wrong. And Rabbi Feinstein says when the Talmudic rabbis, when the facts have changed, we should not assume that the Talmudic decrees apply anymore. Instead, we should assume that as the reality changes, we have new halachot. So, Rabbi Feinstein has no doubt at all that in Talmudic times, lice were spontaneously generated. He furthermore has no doubt at all that in modern times, lice are generated the way little children are generated, which is through eggs. And he has no doubt at all that in modern times, it's prohibited to kill lice, even though the Talmud says you can kill them, because the modern reality is what's controlling in our understanding of a contemporary modern halacha. So now we have four views. The four views that we have are the views of the Pachad Yitzchak, which is that we should assume that the Talmudic rabbis got the halacha wrong to begin with. The view of the Rabbi Dessler, which is that we should assume that the Talmudic rabbis got it right, and modern science is right as well, and the reasons are bogus. The view of the Chazon Ish, that the reality has changed, but as the reality changes, the halacha doesn't change. And the view of Rabbi Feinstein, which is that as the reality changes, the halacha changes as well, and we need to continuously update the halacha in light of new technology or in light of new understandings of old technology. And that Rabbi Feinstein is clear in a number of different tshuvot that as we understand things differently, we have to take our different understandings and apply them. Ein l'dayan ela masha eina wrote, there is to a rabbinical judge only that which his eyes see. Thank you so very much. There is to the rabbinical judge only that which his eyes see, Rabbi Feinstein says, causes a member of a rabbinical court to look at the facts as they are in front of him, look at the principles of halacha, and apply them. And the principle of halacha is that a man who can't have children because of a physical problem is called a pitsua daka. This man does not fit into that category because he can have children, thus he is not a pitsua daka. That line in the Shulchan Aruch, which says he is a pitsua daka, Rabbi Feinstein says that was true in 1510. But nowadays, for whatever reason, the reality has changed, and as the reality changes, the halacha changes as well. Now, I've always thought, as Professor Shlomo Sternberg writes, that Rabbi Feinstein must be saying this tongue-in-cheek, and that he doesn't really, really, really think that the physiology changes, but he simply wants to accomplish the result of the Pachad Yitzchak without the startling conclusion of the Pachad Yitzchak. I don't know if that's really true. It could be that Rabbi Feinstein really adopts this view in all sincerity as a way of bridging intellectual gaps of which he sincerely believes. But whatever the rationale running in the heart of a person, I've learned that you have to read their words closely. Rabbi Feinstein is perfectly comfortable saying halachot found in the Shulchan Aruch that no longer are grounded in scientific truth nowadays no longer apply today. And Rabbi Feinstein's response to your question about, well, what was the halacha 600 years ago, Rabbi Feinstein, I'm sure, would say, as he says in many contexts, don't ask me. That's not my problem. As I said to somebody this morning at an earlier panel about a different situation at a different time, Rabbi Feinstein wouldn't even answer questions for the land of Israel, which was the same time but a different place. Certainly, if you'd asked him a question about, pretend it's 1510, now tell me what the halacha is, Rabbi Feinstein would have said, those are games for children. Adults only live in the present. And Rabbi Feinstein's articulation of the present is very similar to the Pachad Yitzchak's articulation of the present. In the present time, we take the best of scientific knowledge and we apply it to the halakhic principles that we have in front of us, and we come to the conclusions based on the best halakhic principles and the best scientific knowledge for our current generation, and that's all that we can do, and that's the best that we need to do. There is, of course, another view. The other view is, of course, that of complete rejection. Even to this very day, you occasionally find halachic authorities who simply say, nope, anything secular science produces that's inconsistent with the reality around, anything that secular science produces that's inconsistent with classical Torah values gets thrown out. And an example of this is Rabbi Menashe Klein, the Ungever Rav, who lives in this day in the worldly sophisticated city of New York. He says, that which you ask me about the tension between modern science and our holy Torah, we find this many times. And we simply rely on the view of our Torah. And he goes on to say that she'ein lanu ladun b'din Torahseinu mitzvaseinu l'fi chachmei ateva refuah she'ein ne'emanu behem. Says very simple. When you encounter a scientist who tells you a vision of reality inconsistent with that found in the Gemara, ignore them, because they're not to be believed. Because our Torah lays out for us not only a true path of principles, but it lays out for us as well a true path of science. What I like to call the hard version of hafachba, hafachba, kulaba, flip over, flip it over, everything is there. Rabbi Menashe Klein thinks that that's physics and biology and biochemistry and physiology as well. It's all there. So we have now, in summary, five views, varying from full acceptance to full rejection, to Rabbi Dessler's compromise, which emasculates Torah, to Rabbi Feinstein's view, which assumes that you take the best of Torah and the best of science in the present, and the Chazon Ish's view, which is you accept the best of science as true and the best of Torah as true, but we're bound by ancient rabbinic decrees. So what do we do? So what do we do here, in my view, is one of these shilas that very much reflects on who you are. I've always had a very hard time accepting Rabbi Dessler's approach, simply because the basic Gemara learning that was drilled into me for many, many, many years has always operated under the assumption that learning Gemara is important and that this matters. And the reason why we do it is because the way we go about determining how halacha works is by learning and thinking and studying the text. And Rabbi Dessler involves too fundamental a denial. Of the basic notion of the relationship between Talmud Torah and Kiyum HaMitzvot. Torah study generates for us the answers as to how we go about fulfilling the mitzvot. So I, in my heart of hearts, can't just accept Rabbi Dessler's criticism, Rabbi Dessler's compromise, the Chazon Ish's criticism, which says, gosh, this is pretty close to a heresy, strikes me as correct. We might as well empty the yeshivot, something Rabbi Dessler certainly would not have contemplated, but abandon all analytic Torah learning because it really doesn't matter any which what way. So too, I have a hard time accepting, as you could have guessed, Rabbi Menashe Klein's view. I majored myself in Yeshiva College in biochemistry, and there's too much truth there. There's too much truth there to step back and deny it on a very basic level. Anybody who thinks that the scientists who are contradicting the Torah are simply to be ignored because we follow the view of the Torah independent of anything else, is forced to deny too much of the obvious, truthful reality around us. Now, the Chazon Ish's position, it seems to me, is plausible, but stagnating, because while the Chazon Ish accepts modern science as correct, he insists that rabbinic decrees grounded in a misunderstanding of science should nonetheless be binding on us. For various analytic reasons, I think it can be put forward that that's not true, that rabbinic decrees are only binding on us when they are at their core grounded in a correct perception of reality. Once the rabbinic decree differs in a significant way from the reality around us, it's no longer binding. And, this is a very important point, every single one of these cases has to deal with the rabbinic decree, because on a matter of Torah law, it's inconceivable that we would have a blatant factual mistake. So says Rabbi Feinstein in his obvious, cheerful assertion of the way God's work obviously has to be. So we're left then with two views. The Pachad Yitzchak, who says the rabbis always got it wrong, and Rabbi Feinstein, who says we don't have to go that far. We can just as well say Nishtana HaTavayim, the reality has changed, and accomplish the same goals. And indeed, since we're forward-looking mostly, one doesn't even have to resolve that dispute. Contemporary halacha, I sense, has voted with its feet in this regard, which is we follow either the view of Rabbi Feinstein or the view of the Pachad Yitzchak in this regard. When Shilohs come in, and they come in all the time, involving the relationship between technology and halacha, these Shilohs get resolved taking the best halachic principles we can find, grounded in the crispest understanding of technology, of reality, that the Dayanim can muster. And you take the best of A and the best of B, and then you try your hardest to get the details right. It's not always easy. It's not always easy figuring out what the halacha is. It's not always easy figuring out what the right science really, really, really is. But it's important to understand that, at least in my worldview, in the worldview of the modern Orthodox Jew that I am, the notion that one can forsake science deeply grates against my sense of being a truth-seeking person. The notion that I can forsake learning Gemara grates deeply on my sense of being a truth-seeking person. So I'm stuck with all of them, and it's a burden that I'm very comfortable with, because after all, as a truth seeker, we seek truth from every place that we can find it. When the truths are not harmonious, we work our very best to harmonize them. But in the end, we have no choice but to take all of the truths from all of the places that we see them and produce an outcome that we hope is one that God smiles on. In the end, Ein L'dayan Ela Masha Ein Avraot, the best that a halachic authority can do is study Torah as hard as he can, study the secular world as hard as he can, study the facts and the science as hard as he can, and pray that you reach the right result. So this is an introduction, a brief introduction, to how in the real world halachic authorities go about answering questions having to do with the overlap of technical science and the normative halacha. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We have a very few minutes left for questions, and I'm going to be very strict and say that all the questions have to conform to the rules of Jeopardy. They have to be in the form of a question. Please.
Yes. What I'd like to ask in terms of Rav Feinstein's position, do you then have to choose which are the important rabbinical things that have to be changed and which ones don't? For example, the two examples you gave, certainly the idea of one testicle and having children has to do with mamzerut, and it's very important to look at the most modern techniques or advances. But something like fish and meat, which we can live with, shall we say, is that something that you don't change? Because there's no scientific evidence there's a problem with that.
I think your Mary Feinstein's broad wrong view is that in early
Rabbi Broyd, my question to you is, as a Dayan, not just you personally, but could any Dayan choose to follow any of these five pathways now as their decision-making tool, or are you bound to follow a particular one?
Dr. Berger, do you want to say something?
My question has to do with. I'm serious. I actually have a question which troubles me. There are, of course, classic discussions going back to the Rosh Bo regarding the laws of Trefos, which the Gemara lists a specific list of defects in an animal that render it non-kosher. And the assumption is that it can't live with these defects. The scientific questionability of some of these assertions was already raised in the Middle Ages. We haven't changed Hilchos Trefos. So the question is, I sort of be very interested in knowing how you see the parameters on that level.
Many years ago, I sat in Dr. Berger's class. I sat in Dr. Berger's class, and it was a wonderful experience as a young man, so it's, I feel a pleasure to just be in his company. There's a basic dispute between the Rambam and the Rosh Ba and the Shach as to the rules of Trefus. The Rambam says, he notes explicitly in the Mishnah Torah, that the rules of Trefus are halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai when they come to animals, but contingent on medical technology when they come to people. So, for example, a person becomes a trefa when they're doomed to die. And the Rambam says, for a person, you have to ask medical technology in the time that the person is in. And so in the year 1100, if you cut off a person's arms and legs, that would make them a trefa, but no longer nowadays due to medical advancement. But the Rambam says, for the laws of animals, it's a halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai. The Gemara gives us this list, and this list is just an arbitrary set of rules grounded in what made something a trefa at the time that the Torah was given. That's the answer the Rambam gives. The Rosh Ba says that these are Hilchos Trefos, grounded in a halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai, and being grounded in a halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai, says they apply both to people and animals, and that they're part of the godly given mandate. The Shach, though, is much more skeptical. The Shach says Hilchos Trefos are grounded in a medical assertion that most animals die. And the Shach says, when you show me a trefa and a statistical table that shows what happens when we do these things to these animals and most of them don't die, the Shach is prepared to reconsider the possibility that maybe these things aren't trefas anymore. One of the sub-literatures about this milk controversy with this veterinarian, with the injections that they've been giving these cows, is the realization that if these are trefas, none of them are dying. And maybe you can rely on the Shach and take the view that none of these trefas apply when, in fact, we know statistically, I'm going to say epidemiologically, they're not really trefas. I'm not, the minhag olam is not to rely on the Shach, maybe just because we've never had to. But maybe if we had a wholesale recasting of large numbers of Hilchus Treifus, we would move more closely to the view of the Shach, which in my view is the view Rabbi Feinstein would take if pushed. Because there might not be any reason to re-examine these issues, but the Shach clearly takes the view that Hilchus Treifus doesn't require that every animal die, it just requires that most animals die, and since he says that's true, we can assume that Chazal got the list right. But the Shach is perfectly comfortable contemplating the possibility that one of the treifas on the list is not correct. Rabbi Ganach, in his tradition article, talks about this in the milk controversy. I personally think that much more analysis of Hilchus Treifus in light of medical reality would be a good thing, because I'm not even sure how much of Hilchus Treifus we really correctly understand, because I think that as our medical knowledge increases, our ability to reanalyze Hilchus Treifus, just in terms of medical science, has itself changed. So I think personally the Shach is right. I think that that's the mahalik we would take if we were pushed to. But as one of the questioners said, we don't always run to re-examine everything all the time because it's so disruptive of the Minhag Yisrael. So even though push came to shove, I think we'd find we could imagine eating meat and fish together. I don't. And I don't know anybody who does. But so I think the theory is ahead of the reality because the recasting of Minhag Yisrael is scary. And it ought to be scary. The quickness with which one recasts Minhag Yisrael should scare people. Minhag Yisrael is a stabilizing factor. It's one thing to recast Minhag Yisrael in a case of urgent need, like dealing with a person who has one testicle who wants to remarry. There's something to be said for that. There's something very important to be said for that. I always like to quote the Nod de Yehuda. The Nod de Yehuda was asked about the correctness of changing Minhag Yisrael on a particular matter, and the Nod de Yehuda says one changes Minhag Yisrael in order to make the world a better place, and that one simply shouldn't recast Minhag Yisrael just to be different or to demonstrate the fact that Minhag Yisrael doesn't bind me. One should only, in fact, recast Minhag Yisrael when the re-examination of Minhag Yisrael produces a better result. As a final example, and then I'll stop, I'll point to the recasting of the ink used to write Sifrei Torah. In the last 15 years, a rabbi in Israel invented a newer process for making dio, the ink that we write for Sifrei Torah, maybe 20 years ago. The old dio, the old ink that we use, fades to brown after 80 years and fades off the Sefer Torah after about 120. Those of you who look at old European Torahs, you see they get brown and eventually they need to be rewritten. Now, modern books, you'll notice the ink doesn't fade off. You buy a modern book and no matter what you do, the ink doesn't fade off. Around 20 years ago, a man recast the dio so as to have a greater adhesiveness. And he went around getting haskamas, rabbinic approbations on the new dio, and the first haskama was given by a very old Rabbi Feinstein, who somebody said, how can you recast this, the formula of dio? After all, this was the dio used, we use the formula used by Rabbeinu Tam. He himself adopts this formula of gallnuts and this complex formula. And Rabbi Feinstein says, because making Sifrei Torah no longer fade, that's a betterment of Minhag Yisrael. We should be privileged to live in a time and place where Minhag Yisrael has only changed to make us better. After all, that's what we're here to do. We're here to make the world a better place.
Can't think of any better words of summary than those that Rabbi Broyd just said. There will be a 5-minute break now before the next session begins.